You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tim Weiner is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has specialized in reporting on issues of secret intelligence and national security. His latest book, Enemies, A History of the FBI, is a definitive account of the government agency that was created in 1908. It covers the 48 years it was led by J. Edgar Hoover and the American government's oftentimes conflicting concerns with national security versus civil liberties. It's published by Random House. I'm very pleased to welcome Tim Weiner back to our show. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
Now, your last book, Legacy of Ashes, was a history of the CIA. You've written this history of the FBI. According to the book jacket, your next book will be a history of the American military. Do you see this as all part of a series?
Oh, sure.
Interconnected?
Absolutely. I mean, the structure of American national security depends on foreign intelligence and domestic intelligence, and the reach of the FBI is staggering. When I was a cub reporter, the first trials I ever covered were the trials of Mark Felt, who was the number two guy at the FBI after Hoover died, who was indicted and convicted for violating the civil rights of Americans through illegal searches and seizures. Who dug up the evidence? The FBI. The second trial I covered that was staggering as a cub, right down here in Foley Square, about a mile from where we're sitting in the federal courthouse, was John Mitchell, the former Attorney General of the United States. Who got the evidence? The FBI. And the FBI got the evidence that drove Richard Nixon from office, led to Bill Clinton's impeachment, led to the downfall of the national security titans of the Reagan administration. These guys have power. And where does it come from? Gathering secret information. The master of that, the acknowledged master, the inventor of the national security apparatus and the modern surveillance state, J. Edgar Hoover.
And you say that the FBI also gathered enough evidence to impeach not just Clinton, but Reagan and Nixon. But the only one who we saw impeached was Clinton. Was
right,
that political?
But Nixon came within a hair's breadth. He left office first. And the evidence gathered against Reagan was the obstruction of justice, the violation of all manner of federal law in the sale of American weapons to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, skimming off the profits to support the Contras in Central America. Well, this investigation depended on the FBI going into the White House, searching the wastebaskets, and resurrecting a computer system that had been erased, or so Oliver North thought, forensic work that nobody had ever done at that level.
Now, we've had a lot of books on the FBI. We've even had a biopic starring Leonardo DiCaprio. So did you get any new information?
Oh, yeah. No, shortly after Legacy of Ashes came out, about 4 years ago, I got a call from a lawyer in Washington who said, I have just received the fruits of a 27-year-old Freedom of Information Act suit, and it's J. Edgar Hoover's intelligence files. Would you like them? To which I said, yes. I would.
You have good friends. How much was this?
This is about 30,000 pages of Hoover's files, his personal files on intelligence in the United States from World War II until his death in 1972, and thousands of pages covered with his handwriting, the orders of the day in his handwriting. And reading this is like looking over his shoulder and listening to him think out loud. There were operations I'd never heard of, a coup to overthrow the Dominican Republic that Hoover's FBI led.
Not the CIA?
No. Operations against the Soviet Union and Mao Zedong's China.
But wasn't that beyond the purview of the FBI? The FBI is supposed to be involved with domestic issues, and the CIA is the one that deals with foreign issues.
The FBI does, or did, what presidents tell it to do. And, you know, in his day, which was 48 years at the center of the American century, Hoover was the law.
You write, the FBI's leaders live each day in a state of continual conflict. Americans need to know the history of that struggle. If not, when the next crisis comes, they will surrender guarantees of liberty for promises of security. They may be more safe, but they will be less free. So you obviously intend this book to be a cautionary tale. But do people debate this within the FBI?
Oh, Lord, yes. Every day. I mean, the present director of the FBI, Robert S. Mueller III, or Bobby Three Sticks, as his agents call him, is a man who knows and has said that we can't win the war on terror if we lose our civil liberties. If we do, we've lost. And it was Mueller and the FBI that confronted President Bush over his illegal electronic eavesdropping program. And Bush came very close to committing a felony by lying to the FBI, lying to the director of the FBI about what he was doing and why he was doing it.
Did he lie?
Sure.
So what happened there? I mean, nobody even talks about President Bush anymore. We seem to have gone from Bill Clinton to Barack Obama, and 8 years have disappeared from American history.
They certainly haven't disappeared from this book. Look, this was a serious confrontation, probably the biggest constitutional crisis of our generation. Here is the director of the FBI in the Oval Office with his handwritten letter of resignation in his pocket saying, Mr. President, if you don't make this program legal, I'm going to quit, the Attorney General's going to quit, and six people underneath him are going to quit. Your government, you know, the government would have fallen.
And he would have resigned, you think?
Absolutely.
In the afterword of Legacy of Ashes, the book you wrote on the CIA, you asked, do Americans deserve an intelligence service that misreads essential threats of terror, relies on information wrung from torture in secret prisons, and derives unchecked power through secreted presidential orders? Is our political culture comfortable with that? The president of the United States will have to confront these issues. In this case, you were talking about the new president, Barack Obama. But that concerned the CIA. Should we be asking similar questions about the FBI, or does it have different kinds of things to be concerned about?
You will see in Enemies a 100-year history of the FBI bugging, wiretapping, breaking into people's homes, conducting electronic surveillance, all in the name of national security. You will also see an FBI that confronted the CIA and the military over secret prisons and torture. We know about this because of the FBI. When FBI agents went down to Guantanamo in 2002 and saw what the CIA and the Army were doing, they opened up a file slugged war crimes.
Now, you say that the FBI has served the cause of national security by bending and breaking the law over most of its history. Is it fitting, then, that the FBI was established in 1908 by the U.S. Attorney General Charles J. Bonaparte, essentially by bending and arguably breaking the law?
Well, that was Teddy Roosevelt. That was President Roosevelt.
It was at his behest.
Yes, it was. And Roosevelt was not above bending the Constitution, or as Mark Twain said, kicking it into the gutter if it got in the way.
Well, what did he see as the crisis at that point? We weren't at war.
It was threefold. We were at war because we were extending our power. We were taking colonies in the Spanish-American War. We were building the Panama Canal without asking the Panamanians about it. We were becoming a global power, and Teddy Roosevelt knew enough about the world to know that if America pushed its power beyond its borders, that other people were going to push back. Roosevelt became president because an anarchist killed President McKinley. Anarchists were rampant in this country, and they had killed kings and queens all over Europe and the president of the United States. So he wanted a force that could, for which he could use his power.
Well, and you found a memo from him, handwritten?
No, this is actually in the files of the FBI. It's kind of their birth certificate, although you could call it an illegitimate birth.
Because Congress had voted against creating such a...
Yeah, and Congress was corrupt. The president wanted them investigated. And he didn't want to just go against anarchists and crooked politicians. He wanted to go against plutocrats.
But wasn't there already an agency collecting that information, part of the Justice Department and also the Labor Department? Do we need a separate agency?
What we had, and this is the story of America in the 20th century.
They were outsourcing all of the work to a private group, but was that not working well?
The Pinkertons? It worked if you thought busting heads was a way to get labor agreements. Look, presidents from Teddy Roosevelt through Franklin Roosevelt through Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, up to the present day, have seen themselves at war. And we concede the fact that this president is a constitutional law fan, but no president at war is a great respecter of the Constitution, and the instrumentalities of his power of intelligence rest with the FBI.
Now, you begin the book in 1917 when Woodrow Wilson signed executive orders giving the Justice Department the power to arrest or imprison any foreigner who seemed disloyal. This is where the excesses that develop afterward began?
Absolutely right.
Hoover was not the director at this point.
No, but he was the number three man at the Justice Department, and he organized an outfit at Justice first called the Radical Division, then the Intelligence Division, that commanded the Bureau of Investigation, and they went out on Hoover's 25th birthday, New Year's Day 1920, and arrested at least 6,000 people, maybe more, for thought crimes, essentially, for thinking communist thoughts.
Over 1,000 people were convicted under the act, but not one of them was a spy.
We weren't talking about spies. We were talking about sabotage and subversion and ideological crimes.
Was anybody questioning the constitutionality
of this? Oh, yes. There was a tremendous public pushback against this, and Hoover's boss lost his job. His next boss lost his job, and when the dust cleared a couple years later, there was one man standing, and that was J. Edgar Hoover, and that's when he became the head of the FBI in 1924.
And you say Hoover stands at the center of the 100-year history of the FBI like a statue encrusted in grime.
In grime, because there are so many layers of myth and legend about him. The only thing anybody seems to know about him today is that he was a tyrant in a tutu, and he wasn't. He was an American Machiavelli. He's probably one of the four or five most important people in the 20th century.
He had some rocky moments, but he was able to survive them all and served until his death in 1972.
48 years.
So how did he come to the Justice Department in the first place?
Well, he was a young man who'd gotten his law degree at night school. America had just gotten into World War I. And he wanted to serve his nation by rounding up Bolsheviks, anarchists, subversives, un-American people with un-American ideas. And he perfected the mechanics of mass arrest and detention within months after arriving at Justice.
Well, there was also at this time the growth of fascism. Did that concern him as much? Did the lynchings that were happening in the South bother him as much?
Hoover got into the ball game big time when Franklin Roosevelt became president. In 1936, Franklin Roosevelt ordered Hoover to give him the deepest possible picture of fascism and communism in this country. FDR knew Hitler was on the rise, that the Japanese might strike. He saw war clouds gathering, and he wanted Hoover to serve as his intelligence czar. Hoover directed the president's attention back to the communist threat. They met one-on-one in the White House in 1936, and he said, "Mr. President, look, the communists are burrowing into this country. They're trying to control the docks through the unions. They're trying to control the steel and oil industries through the unions, and they're trying to control the American press through the newspaper guild. If they win, they will control the flow of goods, energy, and information in this country, and I am to stop them by wiretapping the bejesus out of them and spying on them." At this point, Hoover explained that he had the power to do this under an utterly obscure 20-year-old statute if the Secretary of State said so. FDR called in the Secretary of State. The three of them sat together, and Hoover looked at the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State said to Hoover, "Well, we can't say on the radio exactly what he said, but bolderized, he said, go ahead and investigate the sons of bitches."
But there was no concern about the rise of Nazism and fascism.
FDR was gratified by Hoover's spying on the right in this country, up to and including Charles Lindbergh, the great American hero who flirted with fascism and with Hitler. And Hoover delivered the goods he uncovered a fantastically sophisticated scheme by the Third Reich to launder money in this country, to support the far right in the 1940 elections against Hoover, and to sabotage the United States.
My guest is Tim Weiner, W-E-I-N-E-R. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting and writing on secret intelligence and national security. As a correspondent for the New York Times, he covered the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington and terrorism in Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Sudan, and other nations. His fourth book, the one we are discussing, is Enemies, A History of the FBI. It is published by Random House, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in the show, Laura Cantrell performs live in our studio along with Mark Spencer. And at one, today's installment of the BBC series, A History of the World in 100 Objects, is about a Chinese bronze bell from around 500 BC. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC receives support from Mayo Performing Arts Center, presenting stand-up comic Mike Birbiglia's My Girlfriend's Boyfriend. Birbiglia shares his romantic blunders and miscues and tries to find reason in the area of love, March 10th at 8 p.m., more at mayoarts.org. New York City Opera, presenting Mozart's Così fan tutte, March 18th through 24th at Gerald W. Lynch Theater at John Jay College, directed by Christopher Alden, director of Don Giovanni. Tickets available at nycopera.com. The New York Philharmonic, performing pictures at an exhibition with Alan Gilbert. Also, Joyce DiDonato sings Berlioz Les Nuits d'Été this Thursday, Saturday, and next Tuesday at Avery Fisher Hall. 212-875-5656 or nyphil.org.
WNYC's Speed Dating Party is perfect for busy New Yorkers in their 30s and 40s. Tickets are going fast, but there are still some for you guys out there. The Speed Dating event will be run by New York Easy Dates, or you can just mingle with other fans of public radio and enjoy light snacks and drinks this Wednesday at Hudson Terrace. Details and tickets on the events page at WNYC.org.
We ask you to share the objects that you think tell the story of our city, and in typical New York fashion, we got a big response. Now it's your turn to vote on the more than 200 objects that were nominated. Go to our show page at WNYC.org, click on Tell the Story of New York in 10 Objects, and then vote for as many items as you want. To see the nominees and to vote on them, visit our show page at WNYC.org. I'm talking with Tim Weiner about Enemies, History of the FBI, a book published by Random House that reveals the FBI's hidden history of war against terrorists, spies, and American presidents. Hoover kept something called the Security Index. What was that?
Hoover had files that were the foundation of his empire. And among those files were the names of initially 12,000, but eventually more than 20,000 people who were going to be arrested and put in detention camps if a political crisis came to this country, if war broke out, if there was a threat of insurrection, or if the president deemed that the country was in peril. And six of these camps were built in the 1950s, but they were never filled.
On that list was Martin Luther King Jr.
Martin Luther King had a special section roped off in the pew of J. Edgar Hoover's heart. Hoover was obsessed with the idea that Martin Luther King and the American Civil Rights Movement were being controlled by communists in Moscow. He had some rather striking evidence with which to make his case, but he had a barb out for Dr. King, and for 10 years, from 1958 until King's death, Hoover moved heaven and earth to destroy Martin Luther King's reputation and good name.
And he crossed the line.
For
example, when he sent that tape of Martin Luther King's sexual activities with a note to him to kill himself?
Basically suggesting kill himself. Now, that was not Hoover's work. That was the work of his intelligence chief, Bill Sullivan, known to some
Hoover
of his colleagues
would
as
not
Crazy
have okayed,
Billy.
And Hoover wouldn't have okayed that?
Hoover would have given his right hand to see Martin Luther King go down in flames. He was convinced that Dr. King and that everybody around him was either a secret communist or was under the influence of the communist leadership in Moscow. He thought the civil rights movement presented one of the greatest dangers to this country. And then at the same time that he's going out and trying to sabotage Dr. King, he is, on orders from President Johnson, destroying the KKK root and branch.
And did he do that happily? Or because you get the sense that there was a kind of a racist side to J. Edgar Hoover.
Oh, he was a racist all his life. But Hoover was happy when he was making presidents happy. And Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover were next-door neighbors in Washington for 15 years. Johnson had a beagle that he gave his daughters and he named Edgar. They drank Jack Daniels together. They ate steak together. They were pals. When President Johnson ordered Hoover to gather the same kind of information on the Klan that he gathered on the communists, Hoover swallowed hard, said, yes, sir, and he did it. And boy, did he make Lyndon Johnson happy, because those were the days and weeks and hours when Johnson was trying to get the Civil Rights Act passed.
The first thing we see in your book is an FBI poster signed by J. Edgar Hoover, who is identified on it as the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And it reads, "Warning from the FBI, the war against spies and saboteurs demands the aid of every American. When you see evidence of sabotage, notify the FBI Bureau of Investigation at once."
When you see something, say something. But yeah. That's in the 1940s.
So this is during the war or
yes,
after
the war?
Yes, it
was. Yeah.
The message, in a way, is the kind of thing that some people would call un-American. It's saying we should be spying on our neighbors.
It should be a nation of informers. As long as you told it to Hoover and the FBI, you were a good American.
Now, let's address the whole matter of homosexuality. In 1951, he sought the removal of homosexuals from every institution of government, higher learning, and law enforcement. And he seemed to link homosexuality and communism, although I am not exactly sure I understand how that
works. I can tell you precisely how. Well, first of all, let's answer the $64,000
question. He never heard about
question.
The log cabin Republicans?
No, he never did. They didn't exist in his day. The idea that Hoover was a homosexual who took out his repressed sexuality on the American people is, I believe, a myth. There isn't a shred of evidence to support it. The entire story is like an inverted pyramid that stands on one assertion of a couple of pages in a book by a British journalist whose sole witness was actually a convicted perjurer. The rumors go back to the 1930s, 1937 to be precise, which is when Hoover started his war against gays in the government.
But he was very close to this guy, Clyde Tolson,
sure,
to the
was.
Point where some people might reasonably have assumed that the fact that they went everywhere together, they often lived together, that something was going on.
Right. But there's no evidence. There is, on the other hand, a mountain of evidence that Hoover destroyed the lives of tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands, of people in the United States for the better part of 40 years by identifying them, persecuting them, hounding them out of their jobs in the government, in academia, in state and local law enforcement. This is a man who persecuted homosexuals, and that is a lot more important than a movie that, you know, shows him to be a man who liked his mother's dresses.
Now, how did he do that? Did he just leak the information to people? Tell them, did you know that John Smith, the head of your police department, is a closeted homosexual?
He investigated them. He spied on them. He collected dirt on them. He looked into their secret histories. And what he found was the foundation of his belief was that communists and homosexuals both had secret lives. They spoke in secret encoded language. They met in secret places. And some of the most prominent communist spies in this country in the 30s and 40s and 50s were, in fact, secret homosexuals. It convinced Hoover that they were a security risk on the grounds that they could be blackmailed by the Soviets. And people were blackmailed.
Yeah, but there were also a lot of gays who were Republicans, as I said. He wasn't aware of that?
I don't think that he would have conscienced that possibility at the time.
Tim, they might have been just making believe they were Republicans. They were all communists. Tim Weiner's latest book is Enemies, A History of the FBI. It's published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One lasting legacy of Hoover's was his use of sting operations. Now, at the most dramatic, we wind up with situations like COINTELPRO, which obviously were illegal, weren't they?
They were later found to be illegal. But let's remember what that was. That was 15 years of dirty tricks, poison pen letters, forged documents, anonymous telephone calls, sabotage against both the Communist Party, the Socialist Workers Party, but also the Civil Rights Movement, and particularly against Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. This was the FBI at its worst, realizing the fears of every president of the 20th century, that if it became a secret police, a Gestapo, that it could destroy the fabric of American life. It was the FBI, to its credit, that found the documentation, again, a mile from where we're sitting, in the federal courthouse in Foley Square, that led to the convictions of the number two and three men in the FBI, Mark Felt, later known as Deep Throat, and Ed Miller. They were convicted of conspiracy to violate civil rights. They were sentenced, and the sentence and convictions were overturned by President Reagan. They were pardoned.
Now, Mark Felt works both sides here. He plays a major role.
He took down Richard Nixon.
Taking down Richard Nixon at the same time, he's engaged in some pretty shady activities.
And but, here you have the balance in the life of one man between the war, the tug of war, with security on one side and liberty on the other. How can we be safe and free?
You write that subsequent FBI directors have also come to embrace the sting operation, if not only for their results, but also the juicy headlines and confidence that they afford the FBI. So how much of when I was a kid, there was a radio show called The FBI and Peace and War, and I understood it was very much part of J. Edgar Hoover's propaganda to make the FBI sound like it was protecting us all.
Well, what the FBI is making headlines doing today across the country is sting operations against suspected terrorists, some of whom have the brain power and political will to conduct operations, some of whom, let's be blunt, are knuckleheads who couldn't knock off a liquor store.
Just this past Friday, federal agents arrested a man who's accused of seeking to conduct a suicide bombing in the Capitol building. However, as we know now, this man didn't pose a true threat because the explosive materials and the gun he had on him at the time of his arrest were fake and had been provided by the FBI. How long has the FBI been doing this kind of thing?
Since J. Edgar Hoover joined the FBI.
So this goes back to the teens?
The sting is a time-honored operation of law enforcement where you set up a dummy company or a scenario into which you lure your target before they commit a crime, not afterwards. When the FBI went global during World War II, they set up a phony magazine, a phony company in Rockefeller Center. They lured suspected Nazi spies in it and videotaped them in a room much like this, Leonard, videotaped them through one-way mirrors and recorded them and then rolled them up like a used carpet.
Well, there are two sides to the argument. This man might very well have found somebody who could have actually given him the material to do some real damage. On the other hand, you have to wonder how much he was provoked into even thinking about committing suicide by the FBI. How have the courts dealt with it?
Oh, the courts tend to support the FBI. When the FBI gets caught doing something unconstitutional, it reverberates throughout the institution, believe me. Look, we have in the FBI an extraordinary institution that serves both as a secret intelligence agency and law enforcement. It has every aspect of the powers of a secret police. If you don't have an honest director, if you have a director who is drunk with power or who is willing to violate the Constitution for some supposedly higher goal, you got trouble.
Or somebody who's collecting all sorts of dirt on presidents so that he can blackmail them when they're thinking of getting rid of him, which is something J. Edgar Hoover also did. But one of the most dramatic stories in this book is post-Hoover, something that took place after 9/11, an initiative called Operation Stellar Wind, which you describe as Cold War tactics with 21st century technology. What was it, and on whose order was it enacted?
It was a combination of three different electronic surveillance programs ordered by the president. There were maybe a dozen people in the government that knew the full ambit of these.
This is President Bush.
This is President Bush ordering the NSA, the National Security Agency, to turn its electronic eavesdropping power on Americans. We're talking about reading your emails. We're talking about listening to your phones. We're talking about tapping into your computer. And this went on for more than 2 years before the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, said to Bush, you have to trim this back now.
And this led to a famous scene that took place in Attorney General Ashcroft's hospital room.
Yes, but an even more staggering scene that is very little known took place the next day. Overnight, Robert Mueller wrote his resignation letter by hand, folded it into three, put it in his breast pocket, went down to the Oval Office and told President Bush that he had to trim this program back or Mueller and the entire command structure of the Justice Department were going to resign. Bush backed down.
You suggest that the FBI has been much more effective under Barack Obama than under George W. Bush. And why is that?
Because the president...
Have they been more legal?
The president is a fan of constitutional law. He has in Mueller a director who knows that if the FBI uses its power outside the ambit of the Constitution, it will destroy itself. And you've got a director in Mueller who has now served longer than any director since Hoover, who understands that there has to be a balance struck between the immense investigative powers of the Bureau and the Constitution of the United States.
And although the FBI still has no legal charter, this past November it put together a 460-page set of guidelines that lay out all the rules?
This is a constantly evolving process, okay? We have technology that is so much smarter than our policies in this country that they give the FBI the power to basically investigate anybody, anytime, anything, anywhere. If it oversteps its bounds, we lose. We lose our liberties. We lose our freedom while we're fighting to preserve them. And this is what makes the history of the FBI really a story of the history of the United States.
Tim Weiner has won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. And his latest book, his fourth, is called Enemies, A History of the FBI. It is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Leonard, it's a pleasure. Thank you.